God, thank you that you're in this place. Thank you that you have joined us here. Thank you, Lord, that sex is your idea. This is nothing that the world came up with. We know that when we do it your way, that it's the best it could possibly be. And God, tonight we turn to your word because it is the final truth and the final measure on how to go about living a sexually pure life and how relationships will work well. God, we turn to you tonight. We pray that you'd open our hearts, pray that you would fill us with your insight and your truth from your word. And God, I pray that if there's anyone here tonight who's struggling with this issue, maybe it's pornography, maybe it's lust in general, guys, girls, maybe it's people in this room who are sexually active who shouldn't be. God, I pray that tonight you'd convict and that you would challenge us to go your way. In your name we pray. Amen. Well, the title tonight is Sex, an All-You-Can-Eat Love Buffet. All right? Now, I know that sounds a little crazy. I had people telling me, can you talk like that in church? And I don't know what we're going to tonight. So, and I was thinking about this topic, of course, all week. All you can eat and then sex. Those are like combining two of the greatest things, right? I was thinking, what our world thinks about sex? We live in America where it's at our fingertips. It's everywhere we look. And of course, probably one of the major sex icons of our generation, of our nation, is Hugh Hefner. You guys have heard the name. I'll tell you a little bit about this guy. Editor-in-chief, founder, and chief creative officer of Playboy Enterprises. He was married in 1949 out of guilt from his wife of her cheating on him before they were married. She allowed him, once they were married, to sleep around with other women. Of course, I'm sure that had a lot to do with where he would eventually end up, because only 4 years after his marriage to this woman, while he was still married to her, Playboy began as well. So not only was he sleeping around with his wife, knowing about it, but he also began these nude photo shoots. And, of course, needless to say, his marriage ended very quickly. 40 years later, after his first marriage had begun, he married again. He had two more kids. He divorced again, of course. After the divorce, then, he decided he wasn't going to get married anymore, and he decided he wanted to go back to the dating scene. He sometimes was dating seven women at the same time, all knowing about it, all living together, all being okay with it. Currently, he's dating three women. He did an interview with his three girlfriends with Larry King, and he was telling Larry King that when he went down from seven girls to three girls, he realized he was maturing. Interesting. And he said he was emphasizing the quality with three very special ladies. That's what he said. Believe it or not, actually, it's an interesting night to talk about him because next Thursday is his birthday, and he turns 83 years old. He's currently dating three women, a 22-year-old, and two 19-year-old twins. Any 19-year-olds in the house tonight? All right. There you go. 83 years old. When they were born, he was 64. Wow. Our world is all about instant gratification. Why wait when you can have it now? It's the idea. In fact, I read that by the year 2011, just under 2 years from now, cell phones will be the greatest distributor of pornography to kids. Just 2 years away. It's everywhere. And the topic, of course, tonight is sex, but not just any kind of sex. We're going to look at godly, biblical, one man, one woman sex and how that can be a great thing in the confines of marriage. Because as you guys are going to see, and as many of you already know, God is not a prude. In fact, God is very passionate when it comes to this. And his word describes it very passionately. In fact, the book of Song of Solomon, which is where we'll be tonight, was so sensual and so erotic that Jewish boys, when they were growing up, weren't allowed to read this book until they turned 13. His book was literally PG-13, okay? This is a very sensual book. It's symbolic, it's poetic, and it's a journey between two people, the main two characters, the beloved and the lover, through their journey of their relationship. When they first meet, through courtship, and eventually into marriage, we actually get a glimpse a couple times of a couple rendezvous they have, and we'll look into those. And then as their marriage matures, and then toward the end, they've glanced back at all that God has done and where they've come from, and it's pretty interesting. So tonight, an all-you-can-eat love buffet, because I believe that is the way God designed sex for marriage. He doesn't want it to be boring. He didn't create it that way. And as you guys are going to see, that's not the way it was intended. This book is very sensual, and it's going to get heated. And we're going to look at all of that tonight. We're going to see from courtship, which is where we're going to start, basically the appetizer of our meal, all right? We're going to go from there, of course, into marriage and sex. That's the main course where we'll spend most of our time tonight. And then on to that, the dessert is the long-lasting love and passion of marriage. We're going to talk about some pretty heated things tonight. And I may make a few of you kind of uncomfortable. And for that, I'll just say sorry now, okay? I'm not going to hold back. I know most of you guys, or a good majority of you, are not married yet. So I'll try to be a little sensitive to that. But I know that the age that you're at right now, that all of us are at right now, sex, whether we're married or not, is a very real topic. In fact, almost all of us have friends that are sexually active, many of them outside of marriage. And you guys are going to see tonight what the Bible says about all of that. Some of you are just weeks or months away from biblical godly sex within marriage. Some of you are engaged. Some of you are dating. I can tell you from being on both sides that it is so worth the wait. And we'll see that also tonight. You're going to see that sex God's way is this all-you-can-eat love buffet. In fact, I was thinking about it. If biblical godly sex is a filet mignon, then the world is settling for Happy Meals. That's kind of how it comes down, right? And I don't think God made any of our bodies for Happy Meals, all right? I'm talking sexually or physically, right? We shouldn't even go there. But let's look at the first three of our courses tonight of this all-you-can-eat buffet. Number one, the appetizer. We're going to look at the period of courtship that this couple goes through. Look in Song of Solomon, chapter 1. I'm kind of going to take you on a brief overview of the whole book tonight. So we'll be flipping around. We're going to start in chapter 1, verse 15 and 16. Behold, you are fair, my love. Behold, you are fair. You have dove's eyes. Behold, you are handsome, my beloved. Yes, pleasant. Also, our bed is green. The beams of our houses are cedar and the rafters of fir. So here we have the appetizer, the courtship period, the dating period. I looked up that word appetizer in the dictionary. Here's how it's defined: a food or drink served usually before a meal to stimulate the appetite. It's exactly what this is. Song of Solomon 1 through 3, about halfway through chapter 3, is the appetizer stage. It's to stimulate the appetite for marriage. We're going to see that this couple is courting. They're preparing for marriage. And this is actually the stage that many of you are at right now, or maybe hoping to be at right now. But remember that an appetizer is meant to stimulate the appetite. It's not meant to fulfill your appetite, to quench your thirst. It's supposed to just get you started. That's the idea. And dating and courting is meant to stimulate your appetite for marriage. You guys need to remember that. If you are not sure that you would marry the person that you're dating with, then get out now. There's no need to continue dating someone if you don't think you'd marry them. You're wasting your time and theirs. And it's going to end up with more baggage and more broken heart than you need. So wait until you're ready, until you feel that you know, the circumstances are right and you could get married, and quit wasting each other's time. Don't be in a relationship that you don't plan on getting married. Because dating and courtship is all about preparing your appetite for marriage. That should be always in your mind when you're with someone. Again, those two verses we just read, they're together, they're talking, they're complimenting each other. Verse 15, behold, you are fair, my love. Verse 16, behold, you are handsome, my beloved. They're complimenting each other. Skip down to chapter 2, verse 2. Like a lily among thorns, so is my love among the daughters. So this is the Solomon, the man, talking to his girlfriend here, his fiance, and he's saying, you know, you stand out. She, just in the verse before, has called herself a lily, which was a very common flower. But he says, you're not just a lily. You are, what he says in verse 2, you're a lily among thorns. You stand out. So here he is, and they are complimenting each other. They're dropping like the biggest, nicest compliments they can, you know? He's dropping like his best pickup lines on her. You know, he's like, hey, what are you, a parking ticket? Because you got fine written all over you, girl, you know? He's just dropping them on her, you know? He's like, oh, you're not just a lily. You're a lily among thorns. And she's like, oh, you know, and she just loves it. They're melting in each other's arms. And chapter 2, verse 4 kind of tells that he outwardly is displaying his love for her. Verse 4, chapter 2. He brought me into the banqueting house. Remember, Solomon is a king, so he brings her in. And his banner over me was love. Now, I don't know if he actually, like, with crayons, made a big banner and put love over her head. But the idea is that this banner, this outward display, was there for everyone to see. And so maybe he's just very affectionate toward her. Whatever it is, he's displaying his love for her. Chapter 2, and then the next few verses, 5 through 6, she's lovesick. It says they embrace. It's this beautiful chick flick type picture of love. And, you know, she's melting in his arms, and it's so great. Chapter 2, continuing 8 through 9, he comes over to her house so that they can go on a walk together. Look at verse 8. The voice of my beloved, this is the woman speaking, behold, he comes leaping upon the mountains, skipping down the hills. He's anticipating, okay? He's not, I don't think he's really skipping, like, yay! Verse 9. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Now, you guys will notice that there's a lot of imagery and symbolism that's used that it doesn't exactly sound flattering at first, okay? Later on, we're going to read about the first time that they're together on the night of their honeymoon, and he looks at her and he goes, your hair is like goats. And you're like, what did he just messed it all up. What is he thinking? But I'll explain it to you. And so you just need to understand that although it sounds a little weird, this is poetic language, and they're just so in love with each other. Verse 9 again, beloved, my beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Behold, he stands behind our wall. He is looking through the windows, gazing through the lattice. Not like peeping Tom, creepy guy, okay? But he's anticipating. That's the idea. He's coming down and he's running down the hill and she can hear his voice. And she, of course, is still living at home with her parents. And he's there. And he's there to just take her on a walk, as you can tell in the next few verses. Now, here's one thing to keep in mind. As great as this sounds, their love, their relationship isn't perfect. Skip down to verse 15. Catch us, the foxes, the little foxes that spoil the vines, for our vines have tender grapes. Now, foxes were known for the destruction of vineyards and crops. In fact, every relationship has their foxes, the things that go through and destroy. It can be a lot of different things. I would say probably one of the biggest, most destructive foxes in a relationship would be lust and impatience. 1 Corinthians 13:4 says that love is patient. That's the first three words of that verse. 1 Corinthians 13:4. You should write that down because you may need it next time your boyfriend or your girlfriend is pressuring you physically to prove your love for them. Come on, you love me, don't you? So why don't we just do this? It's okay. We'll just do it one time. We'll take it real slow. Pressuring you physically. Can I tell you, if your girlfriend or your boyfriend is pressuring you physically to prove your love, they do not love you. Get out of the relationship because the person that they love is themselves. True love is willing to wait. It is patient. And if they're pressuring you, they do not love you. That's the hard truth of it. Now, speaking of getting physical, look back at verse 7 of chapter 2. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, and this is the woman speaking, by the gazelles or the does of the field, do not stir up nor awaken love until it pleases. Don't stir it up. This is so important in a dating relationship that you would use restraint. You'd hold yourself back. Now, I did not say use protection, okay? I said use restraint. Those are two totally different things. I'm not saying that it's okay as long as you're protected to be there physically with each other. I'm saying hold yourself back because dating is not meant for that. It's not meant for that physical relationship. Remember, it's the appetizer to get you thinking about marriage. And dating, the appetizer, is not the time to awaken love. Look back at verse 7. Do not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. Now, skip to chapter 3, verse 5. She says a very similar phrase. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or does of the field, do not stir up nor awaken love until it pleases. Now, the interesting thing about that verse, we can understand it in chapter 2, verse 7. They're falling in love with each other. Everything's just going great. We haven't even read about an argument or anything. They're in love. And of course, at that time when they're just infatuated with each other, I'm sure it's very hard to resist physically with each other. And so we could understand in chapter 2, verse 7, but the interesting thing with chapter 3, verse 5, is that the very next verse, chapter 3, verse 6, is the wedding. So we know that verse 5, she says this right before the wedding takes place. They're engaged maybe the day of, maybe the day before this wedding happens. I speak from experience. The closer the wedding date, the harder it is to stay pure. I know. In fact, Jen and I were engaged for 11 months, and everybody thought we were insane because they're like, how in the world are you going to do that? And all I can say is the grace of God. Because you start thinking, you know, once that ring is on her finger and she's so excited and she's got the dress and you're planning, you know, this is the one I'm going to marry. And in the back of your mind, Satan starts to get in and say, you know, it's only just a few weeks or a few months away. You're going to have sex with them anyways. Why not just get the, you know, the awkward, hard part out of the way, and then on the honeymoon, it'll be great, right? And so you start playing with these thoughts in your mind, and I can tell you the closer it gets to the wedding date, the more you have to work to not awaken love until the right time. Use restraint. In fact, Jen and I, when we were first moving into our apartment, it was like 2 weeks before we were to get married. She, of course, was still living at home. We rented our apartment and started moving all our stuff in, and we knew that this temptation was there. And so we made a rule that it couldn't just be us two in the apartment ever. We had to always have the awkward third wheel with us, you know? Like, hey, you want to come over later on? They're like, sure, great. And we just kind of ignored them, you know, but they were just there to keep us accountable, right? But it worked. You have to set your boundaries and you have to use restraint. Courtship and dating is the appetizer that stimulates your appetite for marriage. That's the point. If you're dating and not thinking about marrying the person again, get out of the relationship. If you eat too much of the appetizer, it'll ruin your appetite for the main course, right? I perpetually face this problem at Red Robin. I don't know if you guys have this problem, but I always order the fries before the burger because they're like, I think Jesus is in the kitchen making them, you know? They're that good. And then he also, of course, makes the seasoning that makes them twice as good, you know? But I order the fries and I eat 7 baskets of fries and I'm like, oh yeah, I still have a $9 burger coming. I should probably have saved some of my appetite for that, right? So keep in mind that this is the appetizer. That's the idea behind dating and courting. Date with marriage in mind and use restraint. Do not awaken love until it's the right time. But when it's the right time, go for it. Okay? That leads us to our main course, number two, sexual intimacy. Now, you rarely go to a restaurant for the appetizers. Sometimes they have some great ones, but you mainly go for the main course. And Solomon and his beloved fiance now, they've spent a lot of time together anticipating this wedding and this marriage. And you know, one thing I love about biblical godly sex is that it's commanded for us to do. Can I get like a hearty amen for that? You know, God is not like, oh, I don't know. I guess since you're married, I'll just kind of turn my back. He's like, go for it. You guys are married. That's awesome. Do it. That was my idea, he says. Here's the thing. Before marriage, abstinence is the only option for Christians. After marriage, abstinence is no longer an option for Christians. And I think that that's great about God. I mean, think all the way back to the beginning of the Bible, the beginning of time, beginning of creation. We have Adam in the Garden of Eden, that poor, lonely soul, hanging out with all the animals, and his job was to name them. Bummer, man. He just had to hang out in the garden and elephant, giraffe, goat, you know, just name. I don't even know how it came up. Hippopotamus? How did he come up with that one, right? But he starts naming all of these animals. And suddenly, you know, we read in chapter 3 of Genesis that God would come down to take a walk with Adam and Eve in the garden. Can you even imagine how cool that would be? But God came down to take a walk with them. And I picture one day God meeting up with Adam in the garden. But this particular day, he's not alone this time. He walks up with the most beautiful creature Adam has ever seen. And there she is, completely naked. And God says, hey, Adam and Eve, hey, here you go. Introduces, I mean, he's like, hey, by the way, be fruitful and multiply. You know, I think this is one command that Adam had absolutely no problem obeying. He was like, do what? Done. No problem. No problemo. God, I just want to speak for me and Eve. We desire to fully obey you. We're going to act out of obedience right now, okay? And God commanded it. He said, Genesis 1:28, God said to them, be fruitful and multiply. Done. No problem. Now, the phrase that I've used tonight so far a few times is godly biblical sex. And those words rarely end up in the same sentence together. It seems weird. It almost felt weird to type those words. 1 Corinthians 10:31 says, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. And they're about to eat and drink of each other's love. Are you guys ready for this? This is the main course. Are you guys ready? Buckle up. Okay, you're not ready. Are you ready? Okay, here we go. You don't normally get a view like we're about to get. Okay, I got to warn you. Chapter 3, verses 6 through 11 is the wedding procession, and we'll go back and touch on that here in just a moment. But chapter 4, verse 1 goes straight into the honeymoon suite. And I hope you never get a real view of this, but we're getting a scriptural view of this, okay? So here we go, chapter 4, verse 1. Behold, you are fair, my love. Behold, you are fair. You have dove's eyes behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats. Remember I told you that was coming. Going down from Mount Gilead. He's basically complimenting her. When people would have looked up at Mount Gilead, a lot of times there would be a herd of black mountain goats that would come down the hill. And when the sun hit it especially, it was awesome. As from a distance, you would see them coming down this rocky cliff. And so what he's saying here is, your eyes are beautiful, and he's talking about her hair. Her hair was gorgeous, it was long, and it was flowing over her shoulders. Verse 2, he compliments her teeth. Nice place to start. Verse 3, as you can tell, he's kind of working his way down. Verse 3 talks about her lips, her mouth, her cheeks. Verse 4 compliments her neck. And then he goes further south, verse 5. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle which feed among the lilies. Now, I was reading a little bit about this verse, a couple different commentators. I loved what this guy said, John Walvoord from the Bible Knowledge Commentary. He put, he was comparing their softness, not their color or form. Looking on the, listen, ready? You ready for this? Looking on the soft coat of a little fawn makes a person want to stroke it. That's what he's talking about right there, okay? He's saying, whoa, I got to get my hands on those, okay? That's what he's saying. Now remember, we're in the honeymoon suite here. They've been doing things God's way. And this is the very first time he's seeing her completely naked. There, no clothes, no boundaries any longer. They're married, and this is all pleasing to the Lord, what's happening here. Verses 6 through 7, things are obviously beginning to rev up, and he's ready to go. Verse 6, until the day breaks and the shadows flee away. You get his idea? Oh, man, here it comes. I will go my way to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of frankincense. Maybe those are his nicknames. Verse 7, you are all fair, my love, and there is no spot in you. He says, until the day breaks. Man, this guy's ready to go, okay? He's like, I know it's night, and the sun's not going to come up for a while, but we got all night, girl, okay? And you are looking good. Now, this reminded me, actually, I just want to touch on this kind of as a side note, on a very practical level for anyone planning a honeymoon or who will. Think about this. When you plan your honeymoon, don't plan your flight to leave at 6 a.m. the next morning right after the wedding, okay? I've had a lot of friends that did that, and they said the first couple days of their honeymoon was miserable because they were so tired. Think about it. Your wedding is like one of the biggest days of your life. That's going to wear you out right there by itself, just your wedding. And by the time you get to the honeymoon suite, you're going to be exhausted. But believe me, those first couple nights, sleeping in the same bed with your new spouse with little to no clothes on, those are very restless nights, okay? And as he's talking about here, until the day breaks, he's saying, I don't want to go to sleep yet. I'm ready to experience what God has provided. Verses 10 and 11 of chapter 4. How fair is your love, my sister, my spouse? Now, this is not actually his sister, okay? You're like, whoa, this got super creepy really quick, okay? No, this was just a very familiar, loving term that people would have, a husband would have spoken to his wife. Continuing in verse 10, how much better than wine is your love? He's drinking her love in, and the scent of your perfumes than all spices. Verse 11, your lips, O my spouse, drip as the honeycomb. Honey and milk are under your tongue, and the fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon. So here they are. They're just making out, okay? And they're just going to town, and he's described how beautiful she is. Notice that he didn't jump on her, okay? Notice that he took his time. Notice that he complimented her. Notice that he's never once mentioned anything about himself except for, I'm blessed because of you. This relationship is based on each other, and each other is blessed by the other one. Speaking of all you can eat, right? They're feasting on love. Look at verse 16. Here we go. Awake, O north wind. Now remember, what was the thing she said before? Don't awaken love, right? Oh boy. Verse 16. Awake, she says. Oh man. O north wind, and come, O south. Blow upon my garden that its spices may flow out. Let my beloved come to his garden and eat its pleasant fruits. She's like, oh yeah, you like what you see? Come and get it, you know? This is her full-on invitation. It's time. I've loved the compliments. We've been kissing. It's time. There is such a thing as godly, biblical sex, and it's passionate, and it's racy, and it's emotional, and it's wild, and it is not self-centered. You have to understand that. It is not about your needs being met. The moment it becomes about your needs, it's not godly anymore. Jesus set the example of the perfect example of humility, not caring about himself, only caring about those who he loved. That's the same idea here in any relationship. They're focused on pleasing each other's needs and complementing each other. Solomon's wife gave him an incredible gift. In fact, he describes it in verse 12. A garden enclosed. Pay attention to the words that he uses here. A garden enclosed is my sister, my spouse. A spring shut up. A fountain sealed. Look at those few words. Enclosed. Shut up. Sealed. It's describing her purity. Here he is on their wedding night. He's looking her from head to toe, describing how beautiful she is. How amazed he is that he has her. That he's there for her. He wants to please her. He wants to be there for her. And he says, you have kept yourself for me. You have enclosed yourself. Shut yourself up. You've sealed yourself. Describes perfectly how my wife kept herself for me. On our wedding day, we shared our very first kiss in front of 500 people. And it was amazing. It was the best kiss I've ever had in my life. And I really felt like she attacked me because she was so ready for it. But I was okay with that. Don't get me wrong. But think about it this way. Chapter 3, if you want to look back, verses 6 through 11, you can read it sometime when you want, talks about the wedding procession. And basically how it worked was the groom or the bridegroom would get a bunch of his friends together, and they would have this procession that would march from their house to the young woman's house, where she was living with her parents. They would go get her, and they would eventually, with the whole procession, go to their new house that they would be together. They would have a feast there. All the guests would hang out. And that's kind of how it worked. And verses 6 through 11 of chapter 3 talk about this wedding procession. It was elaborate. You can read about incense and myrrh and frankincense and gold, purple, cedar. People spend thousands and thousands of dollars on the wedding. But what they forget is that the best gift that they could provide, they've trashed. Because the best gift any of you can provide for your spouse on that day, whether your wedding is a small one or a big one or a medium-sized one, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how many toasters you get on your wedding night or how many gift cards to Target or how many carts you can fill up with your gift cards from Target, whatever it is, all of that beside, the best gift you can ever give to your spouse is your purity. Keeping it now, enclosed, shut up, sealed. That's not just for the woman. That's for the man as well. Thankfully, chapter 4 cuts us a little break. It got a little heated there. It ends, thankfully for all of us, with chapter 16, and no more details are given. We go right into chapter 5, verse 1. I have come to my garden, my sister, my spouse. I have gathered my myrrh with my spice. I have eaten my honeycomb with my honey. I have drunk my wine with my milk. He says, whew, that was good. I am satisfied. And so obviously Solomon, they've had a great time together. And he's satisfied, but so is someone else. Look at the end of verse 5. Eat, O friends. Drink, yes, drink deeply, O beloved ones. Now there's a lot of speculation as to who is actually speaking here. Many of your Bibles may give their insight as to who they may think it is. Some people say that this is Solomon speaking, which doesn't make a lot of sense that it would be in third person or speaking to wedding guests, because there wouldn't be any wedding guests in the honeymoon suite with them, because that would also be weird. But there is another person in the room besides Solomon and his wife, God himself. He's with us here tonight, and he is pleased at this union. He is glorified, in fact, that they are so in love with each other. Let me read that, the end of verse 5, one more time. And just think of, and I can't say this dogmatically, but I believe that this is God speaking. And just imagine God speaking these words. Eat, O friends, drink, yes, drink deeply, O beloved ones. Literally, in the language that he's using here, he's saying, get drunk on your love for each other. Be enraptured by each other. In fact, you'll read it also in Proverbs chapter 5, verses 18 through 19. It says, let your fountain be blessed and rejoice with the wife of your youth. As a loving deer and a graceful doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times, and always be enraptured with her love. In fact, the English Standard Version puts it, I love this, be intoxicated always in her love. Be weak at your knees because of the love that you have for your wife. God is pleased with this and God is glorified. In fact, I believe God is worshipped by this all-you-can-eat love buffet. He designed it this way. He designed it to be pleasurable. And anybody who tells you that the goal of sex is simply to have babies, that's not the case. God designed us to have pleasure, and he created it that way. So let's go on to our third course, the dessert. We've seen the appetizer as this couple allowed their senses to begin being prepared for the main course. We saw the main course there in the honeymoon suite. Now let's look at the dessert as this relationship continues to grow and blossom. I read another interview from Hugh Hefner in Time magazine. Basically, I guess people could either call in or write in, and this article was 10 questions for Hugh Hefner. That's what it's called. They had a bunch of 10 questions for whatever celebrities. One question was, do you ever grow tired of the Playboy lifestyle and regret not settling down? He said, I've tried it both ways. I've been married twice, and the only time I wasn't having a lot of sex was when I was married. You see where his focus is? I look back over the years. The happiest times for me were the times in the early stages of romantic love, when the passion is strongest, when you truly care about somebody and somebody really cares about you. Young love, new love, he says, keeps you young. And 83 years old, he'd better try anything, I guess, right? But when you're centered on yourself, you will never be satisfied. You need to get that through your head, that sex is not about getting your needs met. Relationships are not about your needs. All throughout the Bible, it's about being humble, placing others above ourselves, and that goes for the marriage bed as well. For husband and wife, we need to honor each other as better than ourselves. And the sweet part of God's plan for sex is that the passion doesn't have to end when the honeymoon does. He wants it to last. He wants it to grow, in fact. As the months go by, we'll look at chapter 5. Solomon and his wife are still intoxicated with each other. Look at chapter 5, verse 10. My beloved is white and ruddy, chief among 10,000. His head is like the finest gold. His locks are wavy and black as a raven. His eyes are like doves by the rivers of water, washed with milk and fitly set. His cheeks are like a bed of spices, banks of scented herbs. His lips are lilies dripping liquid myrrh. Wow. Skip ahead to verse 16. His mouth is most sweet. Yes, he is altogether lovely. This is my beloved and this is my friend. O daughters of Jerusalem. I love that she calls him my beloved, my friend. Because there are so many people that I see married that I'm like, did you marry your enemy? Like, you guys have no fun together. See people sitting, you know, getting coffee together and they're not saying a word to each other. And I just wonder, like, what happened in your relationship to end up like this? And I love that she says, he's my beloved, he's my friend. In fact, I always tell people, friends of mine, when I hear that they're getting married, they're engaged, I always tell them that I truly, you know, this is totally honest, I feel that my life, of course, apart from Christ, I feel my life really began when I got married. I've been married for 5.5 years now, and I married my best friend, and we're better friends now than we ever have been. We know each other better now than we ever have. But for that to ever work and for you to ever have a successful, godly marriage and sex life, it has to be centered on God first and your spouse second. You can't put yourself above those things. Of course, we see here Solomon and his wife, they're very affectionate with each other. Even as time goes on, look ahead in chapter 6. Verse 2, she calls him my beloved. Verse 3, I am my beloved's and my beloved is mine. Verse 4 of chapter 6, he begins describing her again. Look down at chapter 6, verse 9. My dove, my perfect one, is the only one of her mother, the favorite of the one who bore her. The daughter saw her and called her blessed, the queens and the concubines, and they praised her. Chapter 7, verse 1, we have another rendezvous. The passion has not died. Look at verse 1. We'll read 10 verses. How beautiful are your feet in sandals, O prince's daughter. Now, this is, again, this is a sexual encounter that they're having. I want you guys to pay attention to the things that are similar, but also notice there are some new things happening here as well. How beautiful are your feet in sandals, O prince's daughter. The curves of your thighs are like jewels, the work of the hands of a skillful workman. Your navel is a rounded goblet. It lacks no blended beverage. Your waist is a heap of wheat set about with lilies. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. Your neck is like an ivory tower. Your eyes like the pool of Heshbon by the gates of Bathribon. Your nose is like the Tower of Lebanon. Now, I don't get that one, okay? Which looks toward Damascus. He's like, oh, you're looking that way? Damascus must be that way, right? Verse 5. But, of course, we know it's a compliment. Verse 5, your head crowns you like Mount Carmel, and the hair of your head is like purple. A king is held captive by your tresses, your locks of hair. Verse 6, how fair and how pleasant are you, O love, with your delights. This stature of yours is like a palm tree, and your breasts like its clusters. He's ready. Okay, verse 8, I said, I will go up to the palm tree. I will take hold of its branches. Let now your breasts be like clusters of the vine, the fragrance of your breath like apples, and the roof of your mouth like the best wine. The wine goes down smoothly for my beloved, moving gently the lips of sleepers. I am my beloved's, and his desire is toward me. You can very clearly tell they have not lost any passion in their relationship. This may be months, this may be years later. We don't have a time frame here. They certainly haven't lost it. In fact, it almost seems more exciting and more heated and more passionate. There are new descriptions here. We read about parts of her body that he hadn't described on the honeymoon. New encounters, passionate lovemaking happening here. And that is the way, that is the godly, biblical way that sex is designed. To last, to blossom as the relationship grows. To continue to grow and continue to be passionate. Of course, you guys know yesterday was April Fool's Day. It's the day, one of the only days throughout the year that you can lie to somebody, make them look like a complete idiot, and they'll still think it's funny, you know? I read about a bunch of April Fool's things that people did. Google, every year, they do something new. They announced a new autopilot feature. In fact, some of you guys may have noticed that on your Gmail. An autopilot feature that automatically answers emails for you. So you could change like the amount of emoticons that you're using, the amount of typos, okay, the amount, all of these things. So basically they're like, you have way too many emails, let us take care of it for you, and we'll randomly answer your emails. Of course, April Fool's. YouTube flipped its videos upside down yesterday. One company advertised a 5-star hotel in a helicopter. They called it the hotelicopter, and they had thousands of people calling about it. How do I get into that thing? Expedia offered flights to the moon for $99. Their advertisement said, save over $3 trillion. And this one you got to look up when you go home, okay? Google Alpine Legend. Alpine Legend, Xbox, Microsoft unveiled a new version of Guitar Hero called Alpine Legend. You got to watch the YouTube video. Instead of guitar, it's yodeling, okay? It's awesome. And so, like, the video, it was this couple, and they were in the living room, and they're playing their regular Xbox, and there's another girl in the room, and she grabs her purse and walks out the door. And they watch as she walks out the door. They throw down their controllers. They take off their clothes, and they're wearing, like, yodeling things, like, like suspenders and green tight shorts, and they pull out the box and they start snapping together the big alpine horn that's like 20 feet long. They're snapping it together. And so then they're playing and other players are joining from around the world, and it just looked amazing, right? So then, of course, at the bottom of the website, it says, coming soon to stores, maybe, possibly, probably not, or something like that. But it's all about fooling people. And Satan is the king of fooling people. We live in a world, we live in the Hugh Hefner generation that tells us to indulge. Tells us that that's just what you do when you grow up. Maybe you're a little, you know, maybe we would say, you know, to the little kids, you're pretty young now, but, you know, society raises us. We've all grown up in a world that just tells us by the labels that we put on things, by the things that we see, that that's just what you do when you get older. I find it so ironic that they call strip clubs a gentleman's club, as if you could find one gentleman in one of those places, right? You have to be 18 to purchase pornography, as if once you turn 18, suddenly it's okay to look at those things. The porn section in the video store is called mature or adult, as if when you mature as an adult, you can watch those things. Do you see the society that we live in? It raises us with those labels, with those standards, and basically it tells us that it's okay to indulge. In fact, everybody's doing it. It's at our fingertips. This is what the world tells us. Let me be real personal with you guys. I bought into those lies when I was young. For about 5 or 6 years, beginning at the age of 12, I was addicted to pornography. I'm not talking about once a week or once a month. I'm talking about my parents made a huge mistake and allowed me to have a computer in my room where I could shut the door, and it was horrible. I can tell you, I look back on those years, and I can still think now that I was literally imprisoned to pornography and lust. And here's the sad thing with pornography. It doesn't stay on the computer. It begins to manifest itself into your life. It led to physical relationships with a girlfriend of mine. I was literally imprisoned to it. When I was 18, God broke that. And I'll never forget that week of my life. It was humiliating. It was horrifying. I hurt families. I had done so good for so many years of covering my tracks and making myself look good. But I was exposed. And it was the best thing that ever happened to me. Because God used that exposing, humiliating time in my life to break the chains of pornography and lust. That doesn't mean that there won't be battles ahead, that there aren't daily battles. Us guys especially, we're wired through our eyes, and there's temptation everywhere. But God broke that. And I believe that was the week of my life that God really got a hold of my life. I was 18 at the time. I gave it all to Him. I broke up with my girlfriend. And I committed to walk in purity. I had been with this girl for 2.5 years. I had promised her I'd marry her. Our families were always hanging out. And I broke her heart. But I knew I had to do it. I knew that our relationship was based on the physical aspect of it. I didn't know where I was going to go. My whole world was turned upside down. I had been being considered to be a youth pastor at the church I was attending. And, of course, that was thrown out the door. The woman I thought I was going to marry was gone and hated me. I didn't know what to do. And I was broken, and I cried out to the Lord, and I committed that I was never going to do that anymore. And I just prayed, and I didn't think that there was really a godly girl out there who would ever accept me for who I was. 2 months later, I met this beautiful girl named Jen. In fact, it was in a similar setting. She was singing, and I walked into the gym that she was singing, and I was like, who's that? Because I need to meet her. You know, and I met her, and we ended up going to church together. And long story short, we hung out and we dated and got engaged and married. And it's, I can tell you today that I've seen both sides. I've seen the side of indulgence. I've seen the side of imprisonment to pornography and lust and a physical relationship. But guys, I've seen the other side too. And I can tell you it is so worth the wait. If you will wait on God's timing, you know, here's the thing with God. So many times people think that God sets up rules because he's God and he can. He just wants to be mean. He wants to make our lives hard. That's not the reality. In fact, the reality behind God's rules and God's standards and God's guidance is that he wants our lives to be the best it can possibly be. And it does not get any better, sexually speaking, when a man and a woman completely guard themselves in their lives and save themselves for that one person. It doesn't get better than that. And God, I don't think, can be more glorified in a sexual union than that. He doesn't set up boundaries to make our life hard. He knows that his way is the best way. And God doesn't want us to ruin our appetites for the main course with the appetizer. So don't allow your dating relationships or your friendships or whatever you're in, your acquaintances, to ruin the plan that God has for your life. Maybe you're like me. You've messed up. There's hope and there's forgiveness. And I stand here tonight as a testimony of that. Because I can tell you, when I was 18, I would have never thought I could ever tell somebody how to live physically, sexually pure. And it's so humbling to think I'm here with 200 people telling you the story that God has done in my life and what God has ahead for all of us if we'll follow his way. Let's pray. Jesus, tonight, we just want to glorify you. God, I know that this is a touchy subject and it can make us squirm a little bit and make us a bit uncomfortable. But God, I believe that you plan sex to be passionate and exciting, never boring, always growing, always blossoming. God, you've done a work in my life that I can't even describe in words. You've taken me out of the prison chains of pornography and lust and physical attraction, and you've showed me what real love was all about. God, I pray that each one of us in this room tonight, whatever struggle it is that we have, whether it's sexual in nature or not, I pray that all of our lives would be committed to walk purely before you. Lord, if there's anyone in here tonight specifically struggling with this topic of sex, sexual purity, get them right tonight, Lord. I pray you convict them. If they're living with a girlfriend or a boyfriend, get them to move out. If they're having sex, it could be anything. I could go down the list, but God, I pray that you'd be glorified in their individual lives and in their relationships. God, most importantly, I pray for anyone in this room who does not have a saving faith in you, that for whatever reason they're here tonight, but they've lived their lives rejecting you. God, tonight, remind them that you want to be intimate with them. You have a plan for them that they can't even grasp in their minds. And no matter what they've done or who they've been or how horrible or the feelings of unforgiveness that they may never personally move past, God, you offer free life and forgiveness to all of us. I pray that they would accept that tonight. God, you are so good. We are so undeserving. Thank you for the gift of sex. God, I pray that each person in this room would save themselves for that one person. In your name we pray.